Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
You are listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Delighted you're with us. We have a lot to get to on a rainy Washington. Politics is getting stranger and stranger by the moment. The Trump show is always entertaining, but it could be eclipsed now by the Democrats' looniness. Now, there's so many people in the Democrat race or who are about to throw their hat into the race that you lose track, and I think most people don't even know who these people are, other than maybe Kamala Harris and Biden. And just, a lot of people just don't know these people. I'd love to do a man on the street and hold up these faces. Nobody knows who they are. But the one at a time, they're coming out and introducing themselves to the public. So we had Beto do his New Hampshire tour over the last 36 hours. And he hit every district in New Hampshire in 24 hours in his minivan. Doesn't he know that Hillary went around in that minivan and was collapsing into it by the end of the campaign? Remember that Scooby-Mobile, whatever they called it? Remember that 9/11 thing where she collapsed? That was actually scary. And she just collapsed into the vehicle, and then she disappeared for 30 minutes, and then she reemerged with like a flower for a little girl. It was weird. But Beto was out there trying to convince everyone that he's not the goofball that he seemed to be in his first 36 hours of campaigning.
Yeah. Andrew Gillum today, he said that you enjoy a set of privileges that other candidates don't. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
Care to elaborate?
Sure. I mean, this gets back to the question that was just asked. As a white man in this country, there are a set of circumstances that are different than they are for women, than they are for people of color. We won't become the country that we're supposed to be. We won't fulfill our promise until opportunity is shared equally, regardless of differences of gender, of race, of country, of national origin, of how long your family's been here, or whether your family just got here yesterday. That's the promise of America.
Well, he is someone who's had enormous amount of white privilege, including marrying someone who was really wealthy, which there's nothing wrong with that. But I think they say these things because they believe it will cleanse them preemptively of taint. And the left is kind of already eating its own. I really have to do a segment just called Eating Their Own. Like, as you know, remember Days of Our Lives, or As the World Turns, as they eat their own. Because they're already accusing old pretty boy Beto of being Mr. White Privilege. And with white privilege, you don't have any authenticity today. You know, you aren't the real deal. Like Ocasio-Cortez, she is kind of the real deal. She's kind of cool looking. She's out of nowhere. She knows social media. I sound like I'm part of her fan club, but I do admire her moxie. I really do admire it. I don't agree with her on pretty much anything. But you have to hand it to her. I mean, she is fun to watch. She is enormous amount of energy, moxie. She's mixing it up. She's trying a whole bunch of different things. And she just arrived here 5 minutes ago, and she's dominating the conversation. That's not so with pretty boy Beto, even though he took in that big fundraising haul. So I don't know. I mean, I think this has been a very interesting and revealing period of time for the Democrat field in 2020. Raymond Arroyo joins us here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. And Raymond, you see what I'm saying. I mean, everyone's focused on the Trump getting sidetracked on McCain and Conway, which we will get into.
Yeah, that's an old wound that I think the president, you know what it is? For all the talk that Trump is nasty, insensitive, the truth of the matter is, my take, he's actually quite sensitive to slights, to things people say and do, and he doesn't forget.
No, he remembers. He remembers when, you know, well, I remember you said this in July of 2015.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
No. He remembers.
He has a better memory than I have.
Everything. And that, so the John McCain thing, I think, is just, he was in a military setting. He thinks of John McCain as the proponent of perpetual war. And that,
but he's also bragging about, he's also there bragging about how we're making all these tanks. Well, that's because we spending $800 billion in the military that we don't have, frankly. And I'm glad we do need to rebuild the military. But to do that, we have to have robust growth. We have growth forecast cut for this year to 2.1%.
Well, and the problem is when you start ramping up military production, there you've got to use this stuff somewhere, right? And that becomes the predicate.
I worry about all this.
It's the predicate for war. And that's
now. See, I'm with Rand Paul and Glenn Greenwald on the ending the perpetual war machine.
Well, and Trump
is
doing that. Trump is ending
the
wars.
He is doing good stuff.
But the war machine.
We're spending money. They want to be fed.
Yeah.
The war machine wants to be fed. And the reason they didn't want Jim Webb as his Secretary of Defense, and I get Jim Webb is he's a prickly guy. Mm-hmm. See, I always say this. I love cantankerous, prickly people. Is that because I'm
not
like that?
Not you. Why would you like people like that,
I'm soft and cuddly. Mm-hmm. But I like people who are kind of – I don't mind gruff. It's never bothered me. So they didn't want Webb because Webb would say, we're doing what? No, we're not going in there. No, we're not sending 2,000 troops there. No, we're not increasing our footprint in Syria. No, we're not. He would be questioning these things. And the war machine wants to keep it going. Let's whip up the people into thinking it's going to be Armageddon if we don't have 500 special forces landing in this area. So that is concerning to me. That is concerning. So, but the president's message is the economy is growing. Let's keep it going. Mm-hmm. Let's keep this going. But back to the Democrats. So the president has a very strong economy and a strong record of accomplishment to run on. The Democrats, as we've been pointing out all week, they have to find some footing, and they're trying to figure out what can we do to put this patchwork together of states in 2020 who will turn out to vote for our candidate. And I don't think they're nowhere near finding that magic.
Laura, the only reason Obama won is because George W. Bush had given him ample running room and a number of issues to run on, war, the economy, and a feeling that the country was on the wrong footing. Trump has taken all of those issues off the table. The Democrats are left with climate change hysteria. We don't like Trump. And people claiming racism and a racist around every corner of every school
right.
building,
everyone's a racist.
Courtroom and police precinct. That's basically what it seems they're trying to run on. That's not enough.
No.
It's just not. So what we're watching is a very odd rollout. These town halls.
Why are they thinking this is working?
Let me tell you, these town halls are more like freak shows than town halls. I mean, what we're hearing out of these town halls, first of all, I don't know who the hell half of these people are. Never heard of these people.
Former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, in a very strange Q&A that involved his mother and the most famous porn movie ever.
Your memoir. You have a lot of interesting stories in that book. One of them is about the time you went to see an X-rated movie with your mother. You have the floor, sir.
So I took my mother to see Deep Throat. And to her credit, the first scene is... I didn't ask the question.
Where did that go? Like, where did that end up going?
I
want to hear
no
more.
Idea.
We cut it off. I want to hear more.
But here, again... Who is this man, and why is this something you would
entertain? We want to lead the country.
At your first outing, your first town hall, I'm sorry, a guy who takes his mother for whatever reason, I don't care if you're a film critic, if you're invested in Linda Lovelace, I don't care what the reasoning is, why would you ever take your mother or anyone you care about to a porn film? Why?
And let me say...
That's revealing.
When, literally revealing... When all else fails, we can say that the Democrats are truly going to pot.
No other government had ever legalized marijuana. Even Amsterdam just decriminalized it. But I believe that states are the laboratories of democracy and that we would give it our best shot. And I have to say, at this point, most of our fears haven't come true.
Bull. Oh, bull, 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 bull. So pot is legalized in Colorado, California, Washington State, Hawaii, and moving all across the country, D.C., New York, you can smoke pot on the street.
It does great things for young people. The mind.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile,
CNN, legalization of marijuana, both for medical and recreational use, continues to spread across the country. But at least from the studies that we're seeing right now, the increase in the risk of psychotic disorders among young people is off the charts. Daily use of cannabis. Again, this is legal in most European countries. He's pointed that out. But here's the problem. A new study, a new research, even CNN is writing about it, Washington Post, people who use cannabis daily, as well as those who use the high-potency weed that's available today, may be three times more likely to develop psychotic disorders than never users. But Raymond, you and I were talking about this on my radio show, I don't know, 10 years ago, that the incidence of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia among the young, and that's from 12 right. to 25, is off the charts. They've never seen anything like this. And John Hickenlooper is telling us, oh, well, most of the concerns haven't been realized. Increase in certain types of violent crime linked to pot use in Colorado, because now there's a criminal link to pot, of this type of pot among the young especially. It's not as prevalent among older people, but those whose brains are developing.
It stunts their development. It causes all kinds of reckless behavior. For instance, it might make somebody take their mother to a porno. You know,
yeah,
you never know
doing?
What you might get if you smoke enough pot. You might think that that's like a normal outing. Driving Miss Daisy has a totally different meaning when you take mama to see one of those.
Listen to this. These researchers looked at data from five countries in Europe where now we have enough data to make a decent representative conclusion about the studies and so forth. So they looked at the UK, the Netherlands, France, Spain, and Italy. This new evidence, by the way, is consistent with previous experiments that suggest that heavy use and high THC concentration cannabis, that's a 10% concentration or more, can be harmful to mental health. This Dr. Marta DeForti is a lead author of this study, King's College in London, and director of psychology and neuroscience. We're talking about people who meet diagnostic criteria and come to the attention of mental health services to receive treatment. Okay, so when you end up at a hospital and parents can't figure out what the heck is going on with my child, my child's like a different person, they link that back to, okay, what about drug use? When did they start? How old were they when they started? How frequently do they use this type of weed? And they've been able to put together quite an interesting patchwork of information about the linkage to pot and psychosis. And so they looked at 901 patients with a first-time episode of psychosis over a five-year period. And they compared them to 1,200 matched non-patients, okay? So they found that daily use of cannabis was more common among patients with psychosis compared to the control group. They found that about 30% of patients reported using cannabis daily compared to just 7% of the non-patient controls. Oh, I understand how they did this now. This makes sense. And use of high-potency cannabis was also more common among patients than controls, 37% compared to only 19%. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that daily use of this horrific weed is killing our kids, killing their minds, killing their opportunities. And so the Democrats are the party of pot, okay, transgenderism reading time in the libraries, because that's happening in Texas and New York. And so gender bending, and we love all people. We're not condemning anybody. God knows we're not perfect. And I'm not condemning people. I'm just saying we're talking about agendas, just what your agenda is and whether it's a broad-based agenda. Your agenda is pot legalization nationwide, probably other drugs too. You're in transgenderism, in athletics and schools and so forth. And then it's
infanticide.
Infanticide, which he also spoke about, and he tried to kind of speak in very broad general terms.
I would make sure as president that there in that every issue within any state that violated a woman's right to her own to decide her own health care would be met with litigation immediately.
Listen to how he said that. Mm-hmm. Which violated a woman's right to decide her own health care. Well, so the baby has no rights.
No. No.
The baby has no rights, and it can be we'll keep it comfortable before we kill it. Every you know why they don't want a debate on Fox? Because a Fox host will say, "So do you agree with Ralph Northam's comment about keeping the baby comfortable before the baby is life is snuffed out? Do you agree mm-hmm. with that?" How the heck is he still in office?
Right.
How is he still in office? I mean, so I think all of this is really
Isn't it
revealing.
Amazing? None of them have been asked about the blackface controversy or sexual abuse in the lieutenant governor's office in Virginia. It's astounding.
Beto, by the way, Beto Blocker was also asked about infanticide.
Would you support this bill that does not in any way limit abortion and simply seeks to keep babies alive that have been born alive?
The way that I would approach your question and this issue generally is to trust women to make their own decisions about their own bodies.
And other people's bodies. So what other people can they kill? As long as they're, if it's a good decision for their body, can they then go kill other people?
This is madness.
No, but he's a dummy. Sorry.
I mean, I trust women. No, you're killing a child.
I mean, this.
The question was about killing
a
born child. Killing a child out of the womb. I'll trust women. Oh, okay.
No.
I don't know how we got here. I really don't.
And
there's something at play where we these issues are not even brought up, and that's if there's a conspiracy, that's where one lies.
Right.
Where you have media types who sit with these people for an hour and don't ask them about the very issues they led with for weeks: blackface, sexual abuse, the snuffing out of an innocent child.
Well, at least that person
aren't
asked.
Important.
That has to have been a
like a student. That was a student at some
Yeah, that was
some
a Republican's
rally.
Kid. Good for him. The kids are asking better questions than the
Right.
How about that woman? The woman the other day is like, "Do you have any position of substance other than your platitudes on your website?" She was a big liberal, but it was actually a good question. All right, I want to thank all of our sponsors, Genucel and Teeter, especially because they help provide this podcast free for you every week and several times a week. And you're going to learn more about their great offers later on in the show. And coming up, we're going to talk to Peter Schweizer. He is so fascinating as a reporter. Okay? His investigation that he's done over years into the corrupt financial dealings of the Democrats tied to the Clintons is just like unlike anything I've ever seen. So his book, Clinton Cash, of course, a huge number one bestseller for weeks and weeks. But his reporting that followed that and within that about Joe Biden, because now Joe Biden is on the cusp of getting into this race as well. And Joe Biden was criticized especially at the end of the Obama administration for being soft on China. Remember, he went over and met with Xi. Mm-hmm. No discussion of human rights, no discussion of the intellectual property stealing, no speeches by Obama or Biden on all of the theft and the manipulation of the marketplace that was done by China. Almost none. So Biden got hammered for that. Well, now we're learning more about why people are thinking, were there other things at play? His son Hunter actually has a big, big role in all of this. And we're going to talk to Peter about that. Because it's unbelievable. Now I'm learning more from other private equity people in New York about what his firm and others like it do with these sovereign wealth funds in China and why they have a vested interest in defeating Trump in 2020, because it all comes back to the money in their bank.
We have a caller, Scott from Texas.
Let's go to Scotty. Scott, well, you've been dealing with Beto for some time. Well, he lives in El Paso, but I remember reading his memoir. Well, not his memoir. We're reading whatever he wrote. He wanted to get the hell out of El Paso as fast as possible, and he left that in the dust and then was dragged back for political concerns after his punk rock band didn't do so well. Hey, Scotty.
I think the biggest problem – hi, how are you? I think Good. The biggest problem with Beto is he's trying to say all Texans are like him, and that's the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, this guy – you know, in 2009, he wanted to legalize drugs, thinking that it would take power away from the cartel. And I don't, you know, his ethic violations in El Paso, his DUI, his breaking and entering. I mean, the guy is, he's trying to be the second coming of Obama is what he's trying to do.
Well, I think he may have gotten at least a slight nod from the Obamas when he went and met with Barack Obama right before he made the decision to run after, well, excuse me, it was right after he lost to Ted Cruz. I think it was reported that in the week or two afterward, he went and visited, paid his homage, kissed the ring of Obama in D.C. And Obama said, are you ready for this? Are you ready for what they're going to do to you? You have a vision for the country? Yeah, you better do that, Beto. And so I kind of miss that. How you doing, Cleveland? Obama would go on stage and suddenly you would say, what accent is that? He would adopt, he's like Hillary. He would adopt whatever accent of the area he was going to. The only thing he didn't do, really, he didn't do a Southern accent. Hillary tried, I ain't no way tired.
Oh, gosh.
That one. Mike in Texas. We got our Texans calling in. I want to be in Texas. It's raining and miserable in Washington, D.C., okay? Raining and cold and dreary, and get me to Texas. Mike.
Oh, hi, Laura. Yeah, I'm in Washington, D.C. right now. I'm at work, but I do live in Texas.
I gotcha. Okay.
But, talking about Beto, but the guy I think is the most radical is Bernie, simply because Bernie was crazy before crazy was cool. I mean, you have you've got Elizabeth Warren talking about reparations. She knows they'll never get past the filibuster in Congress. She's just trying to buy votes. And you've got Cory Booker, who's teasing a White House wedding with Rosario Dawson. He's getting that desperate.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I got to jump in here because Raymond and I noticed that last night that Booker's making a big deal of, we could have a White House wedding. Is that really what people are voting for, to pay for your White House wedding?
He went on Ellen, and she said, I'll officiate.
Why didn't we use that last night? Oh, we should have used that.
There's time.
I know, but I like being first. You know that. So he's trying to tease out this big romance at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? When did this relationship begin with Rosario Dawson?
When she arrived at Washington Airport last week and TMZ cornered her. I'm sure all by accident.
Oh,
they weren't tipped off at all.
Oh, no. So TMZ just happened to be there?
Ring, ring. Rosario Dawson, the big actress, is going to be on flight 213 from L.A. You might want to be there at 10:30 when she lands.
Oh,
who is this?
It's his cog. Colin... Bookman. Remember when Trump used to do that?
You're right, John. What's his name?
John Miller?
John something. Oh, hello, is John.
Trump is doing really well. He's really popular and really... What was that? You got just... Life is really wild, I'm telling you. Then this candidate, Andrew Yang, who I have no idea who this even is, but he's apparently running for president. He's a businessman. Okay, so Dimitri has a lemonade stand out front here, and he's a businessman running for, I mean.
He wants to give everybody money.
Oh, so his thing is a guaranteed standard of living.
Guaranteed income.
Income. And it would be $1,000 a month for certain people. I guess not everybody, but certain people.
The Fidel Castro Act.
Of
2019.
This is what Hamas does. They're like, okay, everybody's going to, here's the cash. Everyone don't, just support whatever we do. So he's asked about this by the forehead over at MSNBC.
Do you know actually what the price tag would be paying every American $1,000 a month?
Yeah, it's about $1.8 trillion a year past current expenses. And so what we need to do is we need to pass a value-added tax that would get the American people a slice of every Amazon transaction, every Google search, every robot truck mile.
Every Google search.
We're going to tax every Google search.
Jeez. Well, wait, but then he says it gives the American people a slice. No, it takes from the American. We pay for it. It's not like it's not passed on to us.
And your children will be forced into labor starting at age 4.
But what? And God. And at one point, he somehow got to the topic that is on that. There's too many bad. I was going to say on the tip of it. And that wasn't good. And no, I was going to say.
On the top of the mind.
No. Like that. Washington Examiner says Andrew
it's
Yang.
It's the needy issues people care about.
Andrew Yang takes a hard stance against circumcision. That's bad. No. So he doesn't want people to feel pressured to cut the foreskin of their sons at birth.
This is what I'm telling. This is what I'm saying and what I said earlier, Laura. Donald Trump has taken all the issues off the table, leaving Democrats with taking mom to porn movies and circumcision as their major issues. Why are these issues important to Americans? They can make up their own minds. They can figure it out themselves. We don't need politicians telling us, and we don't care about your love life or when you want to get married in the White House. That's irrelevant. We care about freedom, opportunity, and having a decent wage and a future for our children. That's it. Not about any of these ridiculous issues. This thing is already devolved into la-la land. This is crazy.
No. And so for everybody who's, you know, worried that Trump gets off message, and obviously I gave a fairly clear message, which we'll play later in the show, to the president on Fox. That's getting quite a bit of attention. Well, I agree with you on that. But the best thing that Trump has going for him is the economy and the Democrats.
Right.
The Democrats. He's blessed by having this group of people.
No, he's surrounded by buffoons. It's like the Follies. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely absurd. And by the way, if you like the great skincare products, clean products that feel good on your skin and give it that glow and the tightness that we all love, then you have to start thinking about Genucel. Genucel, the under-eye bags and puffiness, is my go-to in the morning and at night before I go to bed. It's awesome for that sensitive skin under your eyes, but also the skin around your jawline and going into your neck is also really important. And each part of your face has different qualities. More oily in certain places, more sensitive in others. But in the jawline area, you also need extra help. All of us do. The jawline treatment by Genucel is actually available when you purchase the flagship Genucel plant stem cell therapy for under eye bags and puffiness. There's a great guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And you order now, and you get that Genucel jawline treatment free when you order the under eye bags and puffiness. It's very easy. Just text EYES, EYES 1 to 77453, or go to genucel.com. That's genucel.com. Again, 100% money back guarantee from my friends at Chamonix. So you only have the unsightly skin to lose. And get the best products you can. I've used these for years. You know I love them. Everyone asks me about them. And I promise you, if you go into my makeup kit right now, there's a little white tube of the Genucel plant stem cell therapy for bags and puffiness, and you're just going to love it. And then you get the extra bonus for free. Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com.
In my meetings with President Xi, he and I spent a good deal of our time discussing the outcomes of China's third plenum. China's leaders have stated their ambition to move China toward a system where the market plays a, quote, decisive role. That will require deftness on the part of, and I'm confident he possesses it, the leadership of this country and the president. But, in fact, many of the reforms China's leaders are proposing actually match the priorities we have, leveling the playing field for private and foreign-owned companies. Protection of intellectual property and trade secrets, which is essential.
Wait a second. When did he say this? December 2013, Chamber of Commerce.
In Beijing.
In Beijing. Oh, okay. So Joe Biden soft-pedaled all the criticism on China. I mean, from they were raping us in intellectual property, subsidizing their corporations, dumping product into the United States, ignoring the International Trade Court decisions, rulings against them. They say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And then they just don't do it. They do not change their ways at all. And they're like, well, this is a wonderful relationship. I love how he calls them. What does he call them? Xi or Z or she?
She.
In my meetings with President Xi.
She.
This is she? I think it's Xi.
It's Xi.
She.
Maybe that's even a different president.
Yeah, maybe he thought he was meeting with someone else. Joining us now is our friend Peter Schweizer. And, of course, his phenomenal book, Secret Empires, How the American Political Class Hides Corruption and Enriches Family and Friends. Mm. Friends and family. Great. He joins us now and, of course, was phenomenal on this question of Biden and China. And very few people are talking about it. When we were talking about it, Peter, we got a huge reaction on the Ingram Angle to that segment. And let's break it down for people so individuals understand just how easy it was for Biden to help enrich his son through this cozy relationship with Beijing.
Sure. Well, it's always great to be with you, Laura. The story really begins in 2009. Joe Biden becomes vice president of the United States under Barack Obama. Hunter Biden, up until this point, was a lobbyist for online gambling companies. That was his career. He decides to set up a small financial investment practice with a buddy of his called Devin Archer, and it was half-owned by Christopher Hines, who is the stepson of John Kerry, who would later become Secretary of State. Now, neither of these people that were running it, Devin Archer or Hunter Biden, really had any background in finance. But, you know, why are you going to let that stop you, right?
Mm.
Flash forward to December of 2013. You just played that clip of Joe Biden's visit to China. Joe Biden flies over to Beijing on Air Force Two. On the plane with him is his son, Hunter Biden. Joe Biden, on that trip, he's there for 3 days, gets criticized by the Washington Post and other people, basically for going soft on the Chinese. Well, the most significant event of that trip occurred 10 days later, and that's when Hunter Biden's small investment firm called Rosemont Seneca Partners gets a $1 billion, billion-dollar private equity deal, later expanded to $1.5 billion, with the Chinese government. And this is really important to emphasize, Laura. We're not talking about a Chinese company. We're not talking about an American company in China. We're talking about the Chinese government saying to Hunter Biden, we're going to give you $1 billion to start with to invest and manage for us for a fee. Now, Hunter Biden had no background in China. He had no background in private equity. This was a sweetheart deal. It was done in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone. No other investment bank had any deal like this, not Goldman Sachs, not Morgan Stanley. They were unique. And that was the first of several deals that Hunter Biden's small boutique firm did with Chinese government entities beginning in December 2013 up until 2016 when Joe Biden left the vice mm-hmm. presidency and the Trump administration came in. So it's a classic example of what I call offshore corruption. Joe Biden can't take that money himself. If his wife took that money from the Chinese government, they would have to disclose it. But you do not have to disclose the business dealings of your adult kids, even if they fly over on a government plane and you help them close that deal.
Oh, my God. Okay. So then he says, then Biden in 2016, he echoes what Obama had said a few years earlier. I think I played the Obama version of this, I don't know how many times on radio, because I was so shocked by it. But just when you listen to this Biden clip, you'll see the stark difference between the way Trump treats China and Pompeo treats China and the way they treated China. Let's listen.
I've spent a lot of time with President Xi. Even he acknowledges that the growth and progress in China has been a direct relationship of the stability that has been encouraged by U.S. presence. We're not trying to contain China. We're not trying to slow down Chinese growth. The growth of China is overwhelmingly in our interest.
Really? How is that necessarily the case when it's a communist country that routinely cheats and steals and goes into business partnerships, Peter, with American companies only to hollow out their most sensitive technology and then turn around and say, okay, we're going to make it better, cheaper, faster, and put you out of business?
No,
how is this good?
That's exactly right. And this is the great dichotomy that I think occurred in the Obama administration between the Pentagon, which was saying really throughout Obama's 8 years that China is a rival power. They're starting to take control of the South China Sea. They are engaging in cyber attacks against us. They are a rival power. And you have Joe Biden at that time, his son, lining up these very lucrative deals, not only with this private equity deal of $1 billion. Hunter Biden's involved with a company called Rosemont Realty, which is a real estate company in the United States, which he was sort of put on the board of and got a little bit of a stake of. They'd start doing commercial real estate deals with a Chinese entity called Gemini Investments. Well, Gemini Investments is owned by a subsidiary of the Chinese Navy. So you have literally the sitting vice president's son not only doing deals with the Chinese government financial institutions, but doing deals with commercial spinoffs of the Chinese Navy, which our military says has the goal by 2030 of surpassing us and achieving naval superiority. I mean, this is, in my mind, is unprecedented in the annals of American political history, that you have the family members of senior government officials at the highest levels engaged in large commercial transactions with foreign governments and even companies connected to foreign militaries. And the suggestion that this is not going to influence the manner in which Joe Biden interacts with the Chinese, treats the Chinese, is ridiculous. The Chinese knew exactly what they were doing. They were doing this to soften the resolve of the United States, and Joe Biden and his family were apparently very eager to take these deals because they took them.
Well, Peter, I think Biden is like so many of these folks, right? I mean, he's so many of these political people and business people who see China as just a pathway to make money, and maybe even some of them think China's going to win in the 21st century. So we're just going to make money along the way. But you can't have someone who's running for president feel that way. At least the people have to understand what this is all about, because even if Trump gets some great deal with China, or gets a decent deal with China, if Biden wins, he'll just come along and undo the whole deal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the Chinese government, having had this success with Joe Biden and with other people in American politics, you know, has tried. They have tried to actually float deals to the Trump family, because they're thinking, well, hey, we bought off these other guys. Why don't we just go ahead and buy off the Trump family? And the Trump family has not taken those deals. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. I want it to remain that way. But this is the model. The Chinese government has done this in Asia for years. They've done this in Taiwan. They've done it in Singapore. They feel like they simply can buy off elements of the political class in countries, and that is the way that they can expand their influence. In Australia, there's a major national conversation going on about this. We need to have it in the United States as well.
Yeah, and buying off departments of universities. There's a school that's starting in Washington, D.C., with a lot of Chinese money in it. And all these liberal parents in D.C., in upper northwest D.C., are saying, oh, you've heard about this school? I mean, it's going to be immersion China, and they're going to have the best labs and the best science labs and the computer science. And you hear about it, you think, wow, that's great. Then you look into it, it's like, oh, wait, China's funding this. It's in the old, I think, Intelsat building in D.C. It's a shiny new headquarters of this new school that, even the building, even though it's kind of an old building, it looks like it's right out of Beijing. So they have enormous amount of money to play with, right? I mean, we gave them a huge amount of money, Peter.
They do. And you've got a lot of people, you know, political elites in Washington, D.C., commercial elites at investment banks who are happy to do these commercial transactions. The problem is, you know, China is not a free market, and they don't think of these things as a free market. If they are going to offer a private equity deal to the son of the vice president for $1 billion, they are going to have strings attached to that deal. Everybody knows that. That's the way business is done in China. And China is dominated by this system of what they call the princelings. I mean, if you're an American investment banker and you want to do business in China, you basically have to go through the children of Chinese government officials to get approval and to get deals. They're called the princelings. Well, in the Chinese way of thinking, that's the way it works here. We can work the same thing in the United States. So why don't we do deals with the kids of American politicians or American politicians themselves when they leave office, because it works very successfully here. And unfortunately, you've got people both sides of the aisle who are prepared to take those deals because they are incredibly lucrative. I mean, you know, look, nothing personally against Hunter Biden, but he had no background in any of this. There's no way on earth in any sort of normal circumstance that anybody would entrust Hunter Biden with $1 billion, later $1.5 billion, to invest. He has no background in that area. It's done solely for political reasons, and the Bidens know that. They were just prepared to take the deal because it was going to bring enormous financial resources into their family. Here's the other thing, Laura, and I talked about this a little bit on Fox News. We know that it goes beyond China. It includes Ukraine. There is a bank account, financial records that we got access to. There was a court case involving Devin Archer, who is Hunter Biden's business partner, that was an account that was a pass-through account. Most of the money going out of this account at Morgan Stanley went to Hunter Biden. But what was going into that account was money from the Chinese, more than $3 million from Ukrainians. There's money from a Kazakh oligarch. There's $1.2 million from an anonymous LLC from a Swiss bank that has been implicated on three continents of money laundering. I mean, this is a dirty, dirty thing. And this is only one account. We know that there are multiple other accounts that Hunter Biden was drawing money from. And this is all going on during a two-year period while Joe Biden is vice president of the United States and is point person in Obama administration policy towards China, towards Ukraine, and other hotspots around the world. So if you're a foreign official and you're going to pay somebody off in the United States to try to get favorable treatment, you're going to go to Joe Biden's family, and that's precisely what they did.
How is any of this legal? Like I guess you can do business with China, but it would seem to me that when your father is engaged in negotiations with China and an adult child is benefiting from China, I mean, I have friends who are working in the White House who, when I bring a bottle of wine over to their homes, they say it can't be worth more than $20.
Right.
They say, don't bring anything that's more than $20. I said, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You literally.
This is where you need it.
Literally $20. I think $20 or $25 is the maximum.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean, this is the absurdity of it, Laura. I mean, the absurdity of it is, you know, Joe Biden, you know, has been in politics for 40 years. You know, has to disclose if he has $500 in GE stock, and he has to disclose, you know, if he's got, he gets a $500 campaign contribution. But his adult son flying with him on Air Force Two to Beijing, China, to get a $1 billion private equity deal that he had no business getting, there's no disclosure requirement. So we found this by going through Chinese corporate records. That's how we found it. And the question of legality, wow, I think, is the reason we need to have a grand jury look at this. Because what the Bidens are going to say, their defense is going to be, Hunter's just a smart guy. The Chinese wanted him to handle his money. I think by any objective standard, that's ridiculous. And I think the preponderance of evidence shows he got this deal because his father was vice president and his father carried out very favorable policies towards the Chinese. And I think if it looks like a bribe and smells like a bribe, it is a bribe.
It's just like the Hillary, isn't it? Yeah, but isn't this just like Hillary when she was Secretary of State and getting all that money for the Clinton Foundation? I mean, it's the same.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
These people are grifters. I mean, it's just a grifter. And then they're worried about like some hotel that Trump was already trying to get built in Moscow that never even went anywhere. Meanwhile, they are making money off of all this stuff. It's just preposterous. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Schweizer, of course, his book, Secret Empires, How the American Political Class Hides Corruption, Enriches Family and Friends. Disturbing stuff, but we're going to stay on this issue. All right, we're going to take a break on the Laura Ingraham podcast. We have a lot more to get to, including the family feud that everybody's watching.
Well, I don't know him. I don't know him. He's a whack job. There's no question about it, but I really don't know him. I think he's doing a tremendous disservice to a wonderful wife. Kellyanne is a wonderful woman, and I call him Mr. Kellyanne. The fact is that he's doing a tremendous disservice to a wife and family. She's a wonderful woman.
Well, a lot of folks were bristling at that, not because they aren't annoyed about Kellyanne Conway's husband taking to Twitter to viciously criticize her boss, but that they didn't want Trump to get off the great message of this phenomenal economy and give oxygen to someone who nobody even knows. Now they do. Now people know who George Conway is. But nevertheless, Kellyanne gave a couple of interviews in which she sided with the president against her husband. Because George Conway, once the president tweeted that George Conway is a pathetic loser, basically, and a bad husband, George Conway tweeted back, "You're nuts."
Mm-hmm.
And then this kept going and going. And Kellyanne Conway was actually interviewed this morning by Maria Bartiromo.
I appreciate the president defending what he thinks is unfairness. That I'll leave that up to him. I was raised, though, in a household of strong Italian Catholic women who taught me that you air grievances like that in private. So it is very surprising to see it be so public. Also, I just want to say that we moved here as a family. We have four school-aged children. So you don't just, I'm their mother. I could never have just come here and been here for 2.5 years without them. So we made a decision as a family to move here. George decided he would like to do something different with his career. I totally supported that. He wanted the Solicitor General's job. That didn't work out. Then he was nominated or offered the job at the Justice Department. I've always encouraged him to go be it. I think he'd be a fantastic judge or a law professor. And you know the firm that George works at, the highly compensated partners there. So when a wife of a partner at that firm, now he's of counsel, says, gee, go ahead and do something different. Go ahead and do something different. It's great encouragement to go take a government job.
Yeah.
But we moved here as a family, make those decisions as a family. George was very enthusiastic about moving to D.C. at the time. But I don't talk much about this publicly because my first duty will always be the protection of these four school-aged children.
Of course.
So I prefer not to address it. And if that means people are mischaracterizing me or my boss or even George's tweets, or they're cherry picking because
now. But does your husband know that? I mean, you're saying these grievances should be discussed in private. And yet he's out tweeting. Yesterday he tweeted, "You're nuts. You are nuts," to the president. You know, he's called him lots of names over the last year. So what does your husband say when you say, "George, let's leave this private and not go on Twitter"?
You can ask George that. But I certainly have had those conversations. Just for me, I think the media is getting into a very dangerous area, though, in discussing people's marriages, which is not what's been tweeted about.
Well, the problem is the president is the one who brought in the marriage by saying you're a bad husband.
Right.
That's the problem.
You're letting
so it's not
your,
this
your
is,
wife and children.
Kellyanne, let me just say, I've known Kellyanne and George. I've known George longer than Kellyanne, 34 years. And I knew George before Kellyanne knew him. And then I've known Kellyanne since she was dating George and I was at their wedding. And both of them I love as people. I mean, George is, I mean, he helped me during times where, you know, it was difficult times for me as a friend. And Kellyanne could not be a nicer person. Like if I called her right now and said, "I'm having trouble," she'd be over here in 5 seconds. That's the kind of friend she is.
You know the old saying, while we're talking about Italian Catholics,
yeah.
My grandmother used to always say, "You don't where you eat."
Yeah.
And my feeling here is, we've said it on the show, George Conway's wrong. He should not be putting his wife in the position of choosing between her boss, who happens to be the president of the United States, and her husband. And that's the position he's put her in through these public comments. He should shut his mouth. If you have a problem, curse and kick the dog. Scream it at the wall.
Don't say
go
kick
do
the
something.
Dog. But he doesn't mean that. Everybody's listening.
But don't publicly air your grievances, because it sounds like you're attacking your wife through passive
aggressive
tweets.
Against any family
tweets.
Member.
It's
keep
very
it
bad.
Inside the family.
Yep, it's very bad.
What is the Godfather? Keep it inside.
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family. You never speak against the family.
No, it's you bad. Just, it's bad.
It's
and,
bad.
And he, by the way, he's come out and said, I do this so I don't scream at her when she comes home. Well, go get therapy or find a different family. But you can't torture your wife this way, because she's getting it in the workplace and she's
getting
dealing
it in the media.
With you at home. That's not fair to she or your children.
So
that's what I would say. Can I put my therapist hat on?
Could you marry someone who had a diametrically opposed political worldview?
Well,
from you?
We have friends who are. The Carvilles certainly don't agree on almost anything. James and Mary Madeline. But they get along.
I know. That's like the only couple we can point
right.
To.
It's the only one I can cite, actually. And they, you know, they've carved out areas where they don't talk about certain things. You know, they have their own lives. They respect that. And they have their children. And they share a lifestyle together. And I also think they kind of, those things end up being more important. If you can have... If your values,
your
children, where you live.
Your faith has to have something in common.
It does. Your values have to cohere.
I think whatever. If you're of different faiths, listen to me. I'm not married. I know nothing, okay? I know nothing about this, but I can observe happy couples. And it seems like if your faith is strong.
And your values cohere.
And your values cohere and you love your kids, then
you
can make it.
You can get over anything.
Yeah.
But you can't publicly
trash each other.
I went to the street. We're going to play this on Fox maybe on Friday or Thursday. I asked people, your reaction to this, if your spouse was trashing your boss, what would you do? What would your reaction
yeah,
be?
Yeah, and could you marry or date somebody diametrically opposed? Right. If you want to be part of this podcast, just email us at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Elise in Connecticut, she's in a mixed political marriage. Mm-hmm. Elise.
Yeah, when we got married more than 20 years ago, he was a registered Democrat, but not very political. And only during the Trump years did he become very left-leaning, it seemed. And I've always been very political and very conservative. So it's only become the last few years that it's really kind of become more tense in terms of politically in our house. And we have two older boys who have followed my lead and have become very politically conservative. So that's kind of added to the tension. And, for example, my younger son and I went to CPAC this year, which kind of added to the tension, since my younger son was extremely excited to see Trump. And, you know, that added to the tension as well. Although the Democrats have helped, because my husband, who's Jewish and feels very strongly about Israel, and with the Democrats' lame resolution condemning hate instead of anti-Semitism, we've kind of found common ground.
Hey, here's what I'm going to say, Elise. We're running out of time here. Here's what I'm going to say. Okay, you can turn your husband around. Why don't you try to get him to become a conservative? And show him, look, is this what you're for? Is this what your party is for? Is this what your movement is for? Free stuff for as far as I can see. 70% taxes. Government-run health care, where everybody supposedly has access to care but just gets in a line. And they're controlling every decision regarding cars, who you travel, when you travel. Oh, now they want to tax internet searches. So this is where its own 16-year-olds can vote and we can have an open border. So, I mean, this is the greatest recruiting opportunity that we have right now in America is the Democrat Party. We have a huge recruiting opportunity for conservatives by demonstrating the radicalism, where it's going to lead us, and how it's going to result in less freedom for you and less prosperity. So they think that Trump is a recruiting tool for the Democrats? No. The Democrats are a recruiting tool for Trump. and the movement beyond Trump that's going to way outlast Trump. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast. By the way, millennials apparently today care more about a date's politics than whether or not you're going to have a good chemistry with your date or spouse, future spouse. So this is how politics has infected everything. So again, millennials today who in the last survey said that they're the most anxious they've ever been because they're anxious if they lose Wi-Fi or get a cracked computer screen. I mean, the millennials, I mean, let's just say we screwed the millennials up big time. I mean, it's the first everybody gets a trophy crowd, right? First of that generation where everybody gets a trophy. And I want to remind every one of you who has ever had back problems about the wonders of the teeter inversion table. I've had back problems on and off. It's not all the time, but it's enough of the time to make me realize you got to do something. So you can do yoga, your stretches at home, elongate your spine. But the best way to just get into a habit, so you address problems when they pop up, but also prevent problems with your back, especially those of you who sit, is with a little time on this inversion table at least once a day and preferably morning and night. And Teeter is the name, basically the best name in inversion tables. They've been manufacturing these since 1981. They're the best known company in the United States. Over 3 million people have put their trust in Teeter. All you need to do to learn more about how this can help you get a healthier lifestyle, healthier back health, is go to teeter.com/Laura. That's TEETER.com/Laura. You'll get free shipping, free returns, $70 off, plus $100 worth of bonus accessories. Very easy. Teeter.com/Laura. And remember, you get free returns, 60-day money-back guarantee. It's just a no-brainer. Try it, and you'll see. Teeter.com/Laura. That's teeter.com/Laura. Coming up, we're going to talk to Jordan Peterson, the sissifying of our new generations of men. What does that mean? Is that an unfair statement? Is a mischaracterization? Aren't we just wanting to raise kids that are more sensitive and compassionate? What's wrong with that? Well, there's an interesting conversation to be had about what the culture is doing to the genders. Jordan Peterson's going to join us, and your calls. Remember, just email us at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. His book, by the way, has been removed from a New Zealand bookstore. That's too controversial. Don't go away.
There's an intolerance that's being spread in this country, in this world, and it comes from the political dialogue. Let's be clear, it comes from political leaders.
We need to be mindful in our own rhetoric and in our own actions how we're pushing it.
The language he uses in this manifesto is all about invaders. It's also language that President Trump used in a campaign ad before the midterm election.
Yeah. This shooter specifically invoked our president as an inspiration.
President Trump, whether intentionally or I think in a lot of cases even inadvertently, has provided a lot of fodder for people like this.
Well, this was the lowest of the low last week. So after this New Zealand massacre, where you got this whack job and he writes a manifesto that was designed to divide people, designed to send people down this, you know, rat hole of recriminations and blame shifting and so forth, the media just laps it all up. Of course, there's no coverage of the 12 churches burned in Europe over the last few days. We covered it on the Ingram Angle last night. And the relentless attacks on Muslims, Jews, and Christians by Islamists that have been going on now for decades, especially in the last 10 years or so. It's the height of cruelty toward others who disagree with the Islamists. We could do entire shows every day just on that topic. But nevertheless, the power of words. And Trump represents, I think, to the left, this old style, kind of no holds barred, masculine, I'm going to dominate the room. I'm going to take the field. America's going to win. We love winning. We're the biggest, the best. They don't like that. It makes them very uncomfortable when the United States is on top. They like it when America is bowing down or apologizing or just part of the great global community, as Obama and Biden, you know, love to be. That's why the Europeans are all saying, telling Biden that he has to run, because they don't like this whole populist movement cropping up all over Europe, because it disempowers the elites. So the power of language and the idea of masculinity really is interwoven into this current debate about, and even beyond, way beyond Trump and where Trump is. And someone has written so persuasively about all of these types of issues beyond politics into the culture is Jordan Peterson. Of course, his book, 12 Rules for Life, the paperback, just coming out, and it was a massive worldwide bestseller. He joins us now to talk about how they're even taking his book out of bookstores in New Zealand, because the power of ideas, they're too powerful to in the wrong hands, or they're toxic themselves, so they have to be removed from the public square, which just diminishes our ability to think and have free debate. He joins us now. Jordan, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thank you for the invitation.
Jordan, let's talk about this socio-political landscape that has developed around us about language and ideas, and how the left, especially, every time there's a tragedy that they can pin on others, more traditional thinkers, they rush in to do that rather than have a debate about the underlying issue.
Well, people want to come up with a solution that's in accordance with what they already believe, because that's cognitively the most straightforward thing to do. I mean, it's the proclivity of people everywhere to use their already formulated ideas whenever they have the opportunity to do so. And then you also pointed out in the intro that the person who perpetrated the massacre in New Zealand had written a manifesto that was specifically aimed at increasing division and this positive feedback loop partisanship that we see emerging in the media and on social media.
Now, what part of this your book is dangerous to their worldview? What specifically about 12 rules for life? That they're pretty basic rules, like make your bed and there's some basic things that were traditional things. They were basic to all of us growing up.
Well, they were designed that way. I mean, when I wrote the rules, I knew perfectly well that they were, in some sense, you might consider them self-evident maxims. And so, of course, that raises the question of why they need to be written about or defended. But I would say in a chaotic time, it's necessary for people to begin to understand consciously what they've always abided by unconsciously. Otherwise, everyone ends up far too confused. I think the fundamental threat that my work poses to the radicals on the left, but also the identitarian types on the right, is that I'm writing about the centrality of the individual, especially in relationship to responsibility rather than rights, let's say, and that I insist on the utility, necessity, inevitability, and functionality of hierarchies, even at the basic level of perception, because it is the case, and I outline this, for example, in Chapter 10, which is called Be Precise in Your Speech. You can't look at the world without viewing it through a hierarchy, because you have to organize what's important before you can perceive what's necessary. And so the radical left is very much threatened by the emphasis that I'm placing on the individual as the primary unit of analysis, and by the insistence that I have that hierarchies are not only inevitable, but necessary, crucially necessary. And the breakdown of hierarchy, very, very dangerous thing.
Well, when you see young people, as you probably saw the video, Jordan, of that kid cracking the egg on the head of that right-wing politician in Australia who, I don't know, made some comment that got everyone upset after the Christchurch killing. The kid goes up, he's 17, cracks the egg on his head, and is video cracking it on one hand, with one hand, videoing it with his cell phone on the other. The official smashes, cuffs him back, smacks him back, which is, think about this, what my father would have done. He would have backhanded me right in the car as we were driving. So he pushes him back, and then that kid becomes celebrated. He is celebrated globally. You showed him, and kids are speaking to adults in a manner in which I wouldn't have dreamed of speaking to adults. I mean, I still call my neighbors growing up in Connecticut, I still say, you know, Mrs. Johnson and Mr. Kosmeski, and I would never, and they say, oh, call me by my first name. You know, you're 55 years old. No, I'm not going to call you by your first name. You're Mr. That's how we were raised. But now that's all out the window. Speaking of hierarchical problems.
Well, it's part of a continued assault on the idea of value itself, I would say, and on the idea that things have to be organized in terms of the primacy of their importance. I see it as I've explained this in some detail in my first book, Maps of Meaning, and in my lectures, and in this latest book. I see it as a continuation of the destruction of the idea of order itself. I mean, even the mantra of the age, say diversity, inclusivity, equity, is profoundly anti-hierarchical. It couldn't be more anti-hierarchical. And the thing is that hierarchies aren't without their dangers. Anyone sensible understands that, because if a hierarchy is a structure of order, which is certainly one of the things that it is, it can become rigid and it can become dysfunctional in that it no longer performs the operations that it was designed to perform. You know, most of the time, what happens, as far as I can tell, is that we as human beings have complex problems to solve because of our fragility. And we organize ourselves into cooperative and competitive hierarchies that are aimed at addressing those problems. That's how a functional society works. And then your position in the hierarchy is a function of your utility with regards to the solution of that particular problem. I mean, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone in some sense. And every business is devoted towards solving a problem, providing a solution. Mm-hmm. You can argue about whether all the solutions are necessary, but that's a free market issue to some degree for that determination to be made. But there's no possibility of organizing ourselves properly and solving those complicated problems without hierarchy. And no one is educated anymore, I would say, to understand why that's not only useful but psychologically necessary for people. We can't survive sanely without order, because everything comes flooding in. That's the thing. When the walls crumble, everything comes flooding in. I would say psychologically, that's part of the reason that Trump's message was so attractive to people. The idea of the wall, you know, because the idea of the wall is a centrally conservative idea.
Yes.
In the classic sense. And what walls do is separate some things from other things so that everything doesn't blur into one overwhelming chaotic mass. And increasingly, people have the sense that that's what's happening. And so when Trump says something like, well, let's build a wall, it's very, very attractive to the part of the psyche that's overwhelmed by transformation and change that's too rapid.
Too fast. And, yeah.
And too much information as well. Information flow that's too, what would you say? It's transforming at a rate that no one can adapt to.
No, and I think, like, you point out, and it's a very interesting way of looking at it. You point out that we moved for centuries or millennia as in packs. People moved in packs, family packs. There were multiple families moving together. And a hierarchy naturally develops through strength and skill. Certain people have skills in sewing. Others have skills in hunting. Others have brain power that can see enemies in the distance. That develops over long expanses of time. And it only became clear, like, why this was happening when we developed further as human beings. Like, why did this all work? We never even thought about it. And then it became instinct for us to live this way. But today, with the rise of social media and the blurring of the lines between, I think, adults and children, which adults want to be infants their whole entire lives. They want to be infantilized, and children want to be adults. Like, it's a crazy dynamic we have now. Now we're having the push for, egalitarianism. It's all everyone's going to be equal. We're going to have an equal standard of living, equal salaries. It's going to be free college, free pre-K, free universal pre-K, free healthcare. Everyone's going to be equal, but then no one ever is really going to emerge equally at the same time. That never could happen. It hasn't happened through human history, but somehow they think it's going to work now.
It's crazy. You know, the desire for a certain degree of equality is part of standard morality. Let's say, you know, it's not like anyone, regardless of their political position, is pleased emotionally when they walk down the street and they see someone who's devastated and alcoholic and homeless. You know, it produces a pang in the soul of anyone with a conscience, and the attendant desire, at least from the perspective of compassion, to have a society organized so that such things don't occur. That's the emotional driver for that egalitarian vision. The problem is that egalitarian compassion alone is of insufficient sophistication to build a complex functional society. You need compassion and mercy, but you need justice and order as well. And those are of equal import, and they fight in some sense across mm-hmm. historical spans of time for predominance. You know, you want justice tempered with mercy, but by the same token, as we already discussed, without a hierarchy, you can't even perceive the world, and you can't organize yourself, to, especially in groups, to do anything of any utility. And the radical postmodernists in particular, in their strange association with the radical leftists, insist that every hierarchical structure is composed of nothing but the expression of raw power. And that's unbelievably pernicious because it destroys the idea of competence and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, there's multiple problems with that. One is that, well, you're flooded, as I said before, by too much of everything. But you also have no goal anymore. You know, you said that children want to be adults, or at least they want to have the, let's say, the privileges of adults, and that adults want to be children. And I think that young people are having a hard time deciding that growing up is worthwhile, because if you destroy the idea of a hierarchy of order, you destroy the idea that maturity is possible and valuable. That functional maturity and competence itself is desirable. And so if the hierarchy is flattened and there's no up, there's no impetus for forward movement. And it's even worse than that, you know, psychologically mm-hmm. speaking, because if there's no impetus towards forward movement, because nothing is more valuable than anything else, then there's no positive emotion, you see, because we're biologically constructed so that we experience a sense of engagement in the world when we see ourselves successfully pursuing a valued goal. And that assumes we have valued goals, and that assumes that we have a hierarchy.
Well, that's why nationalism, it, properly understood, nationalism meaning love of country, not perverted nationalism to indicate oppression and subjugation, but nationalism meaning love of country, like you love your nation. That's what when real we love our nation, we want to work with other countries, but we love our country. Love of country subverted by individual groups that say, okay, standing for the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, you're agreeing with the patriarchy. They do this to you, Jordan. When you go speak, as I saw that protester in Melbourne, and we're going to play this soundbite, they seek out individuals to brand them as part of the social unfairness that's pervasive because of this hierarchical structure that they want to destroy. Let's listen.
Bush is always there to confront any far right or fascist presence. Now, Jordan Peterson is really just part of that far right that's there to pump out the misogyny and the homophobia and the racism and the transphobia blah, blah, blah. That we're very well aware of. But their whole purpose in coming on these tours of Australia is to build a global far-right movement. So this is why we have to be there every time.
So, Jordan, you're working on building that global... You sound pretty mild-mannered to me. I don't know. You said building that global far-right movement of this crazy idea of individual liberty and freedom and free thought and free expression. It's very dangerous.
Well, it's mostly, and this is the crucial issue, and I think this is what separates my thinking in some sense and what I'm doing from whatever might be comparable or conceivably comparable is that the individuality that I'm stressing is conceptual first. So the idea is that the primary lens through which another should be viewed is the lens of individuality. And the second element is that I'm speaking primarily about individual responsibility, not individual rights. And so this isn't it has nothing to do with the right wing in a political sense. It has nothing to do with the left wing in a political sense either, because it's not a political idea. The idea is that it's a psychological idea, and the idea is that your best bet with regards to contending with the tragedy of the world without becoming bitter and hurt and vengeful is to adopt a responsible stance towards being and to tell the truth and to act courageously and to extend that responsibility to your family and your community. You know, and nationalism, the nationalism that you referred to in its positive aspect is the extension of that responsibility to the community.
To each other.
It's also predicated on the idea that your community can't be infinitely large in scope. And that's the Tower of Babel problem, I would say, fundamentally, is that, and this is exactly what's plaguing the European Economic Union, is that as the scale of the collective enterprise expands, the distance between the individual citizens and the people who are the elites, as you call them, grows necessarily. So it's a problem of hierarchy, perversely enough, even though it's something that's supported by the left. People feel that once their groups have gone beyond a certain size, that there's nothing about them that constitutes a collective project, and that they have no voice or influence in that process. And so they become alienated, and that's when fragmentation begins to occur. You can't be powerless. You can't be without influence in the group you identify with, because otherwise it's not your group. It's like you're not on the team. You're not playing the game. The game isn't even on anymore. And the people who are opposed to national borders, let's say, don't understand that the demolition of the local will produce much larger, much
chaos,
more rigid, and much less responsive hierarchies.
I want to play something for you, Jordan, about, and this cuts right into what you're talking about with the with how people are trying to find their own identity or group that they can have influence in, and I think it also addresses this issue of the perpetual. We're all infants. I mean, no one wants to stand up and take personal responsibility for his or her actions or life when it's much easier to blame some other collective or other individual for your problems. Some people blame mommy and daddy, spend their whole life talking about mommy and daddy did this to me and my mommy and daddy did. Okay. All right. Now what are you going to do? All right. And then there's another issue, and that's that issue of privilege that Ocasio-Cortez talks about. Let's listen.
Almost every single person in this country can acknowledge some privilege of some type. You know,
right.
I'm a cisgendered woman. I will never know the trauma of feeling like I'm not born in the right body. Mm-hmm. And that is a privilege that I have, mm-hmm. no matter how poor my family was when I was born. But it's really hard for some people to admit.
Well, she's basically saying that people are different. And so if you're different, then everybody has privilege. Take it away from the cisgender
thing. It's a dangerous and vacuous statement. And the reason that it's vacuous is the reason that you just pointed out, which is that we're all positioned in the world differently. And so we have a different range of, let's call them, opportunities and obstacles that confront us on a day-to-day and month-to-month basis. And so it's self-evident. But the dangerous part of that is, you see, this is one of the things I started to understand as I took apart what happened after the Russian Revolution and why it went so terribly wrong. You see, if you can identify dimensions of privilege, let's say that those would be associated with group identity, right? They frequently are. Dimensions of privilege. She talked about being cisgendered, for example, which, by the way, is a term I absolutely despise. But you can take apart everyone and you can find one dimension, and this is exactly what she says, you can find one dimension at least along which everyone has been unfairly advantaged by the past for some reason. And then, that's one thing. But the next thing is then if you believe in radical equality of outcome as your goal, then all of that unfair privilege has to be eradicated. And what happens is that the privilege isn't eradicated. It's the people with the privilege that end up eradicated. And it's so dangerous because, I mean, it's so comical to hear Ocasio-Cortez point this out. She said, well, everyone has undeserved privilege. It's like, okay, well, if we're going to get rid of undeserved privilege, then what does that mean if everyone has it? And the proper response to that, as far as I'm concerned, is to be grateful for what you have and to bear your, what would you call it, to bear your inequalities with dignity, but to act responsibly as an individual agent. This is what the West figured out thousands of years ago, I would say, is that, of course, life is arbitrary and unfair. Obviously, there's nothing more obvious than that. So what do you do about that? And the answer is, well, you try to gratefully utilize your arbitrary talents in a manner that's beneficial, and you try to bear your unfair suffering with dignity and courage and not to become resentful and cruel because of it. That's your moral obligation. And I think I made a very strong case for that. I think I've been continually making a strong mm-hmm. case for that in my lectures and my books. And yeah. I don't see a more solid solution than that. It's okay to admit that it's unfair. I mean, obviously, what could be more obvious that the fact that there are these tremendous differences between people indicates a fundamental arbitrariness about the structure of being itself. And the question is, what do you do in the face of that? And the answer is, you bear your cross uphill. That's the answer.
You know who does this and speaks about this? And you maybe have met him, but if you haven't, I'm going to introduce you to him. My old boss, Clarence Thomas, and his book, My Grandfather's Journey, where this is like the whole book. It was about, you know, he slept in a chair for the first, I think, 4 years of his life. He had no bed, and he had a pillow on a wooden chair. He had no, you know, his grandparents had to take him in because his mother had a lot of problems. And he was living in the South in Pinpoint, Georgia, dirt floor, dirt poor. And all the things he faced, all the things he went through, what his grandfather taught him, who was obviously lived in the segregated South, grew up there, dealt with all of this horrible discrimination. And he basically said, life lessons, Jordan, that were like this. And I say this to my kids, and they remember this. My son will say, I said, what's that in your hand? He said, that's my friend's lunchbox. I borrowed it from him. And then my other son, Dimitri, will say, don't ever take anything that's not yours from anybody, not even if it's a penny. Because that's what Justice Thomas's grandfather drilled into him as a young man. That, yeah, other people have more than you and always will, but don't you ever give away your power of your values and your morality and compromise your power. That compromises your own individual dignity and worth. Don't ever do that. It stays with me.
Yes. Well, it compromises your integrity, and in this manner that has to be unpacked so that it's not a cliche.
Right.
It's like what you have to contend with the world is your integrity, and that's your honesty fundamentally, mm-hmm. and your honesty and your courage, and it isn't like the people on the left are incorrect when they point to the injustice of inequality. It's that the solution is not only untenable, but will necessarily make things far worse.
And much more divisive.
All of the radical leftist experiments in the 20th century indicated quite clearly that, well, first of all, that inequality wasn't a function of capitalism, which is an absolute leftist delusion.
Why?
To presume that inequality is something so easily explained away. And their solutions that were imposed made inequality far worse than it had been under the previous regimes. It's certainly not unreasonable to point out that inequality has this existentially painful quality.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and I think, you know, that's where we can end this today, is that, again, you can feel for, and everyone feels for individuals who, they didn't get a fair start in life, they didn't get a fair shake in life, and they've dealt with enormous physical, health, socioeconomic problems, and continue to. But the solution is, you know, let's give everybody an opportunity to better themselves in a society that is orderly, safe, with safety, and where we don't encourage more, I think, division and resentment, which is what reparations. Next time we talk to you, Jordan, we're going to talk about the reparations push, which is growing in the United States.
I saw that. That's it's absolutely insane. It's Elizabeth
it's
Warren
growing.
should be terminally ashamed of herself. It's an absolutely appalling idea, but it's a logical outgrowth of the notion of identity, group identity as the fundamental identity. So black versus white, let's say, with whites in this situation being the perpetrator. I don't know how this is going to work in practically. I mean, What if your white ancestors were fought for the North in the Civil War? Does that give you a discount on the reparations?
No, you get no discount.
Is this just a general guilt that's shared by all people who are white? And how exactly are you going to define that? That it's such a nightmare. It's just a miracle to me that a negative miracle to me that this can be. That this idea can be being discussed by people who have serious political pretensions.
Jordan,
it's so insane.
You know what my view is? My view is Elizabeth Warren, She has a lot of self-interest. She has a conflict of interest in this because she thinks somehow the indigenous people, the Native Americans, will also get reparations so she can jump on that bandwagon. So she gets the 1/1,000th, 12th percent of all of this. Jordan Peterson, it's so great to talk to you. I can't wait to have you on the Ingram Angle when you're in New York. We'll work on that. And congratulations on all your success. You're a brainiac who's really, you made brainiacs cool and thinking about all these extremely important issues. And so many young people have had their eyes opened by you. And just keep it up. And anything we can ever do for you, just let us know, okay?
Thank you. It was very nice talking with you.
All right, Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life, paperback just about out. All right, you're listening to the Laura Ingram Podcast. And remember, thanks to all our sponsors for supporting this show, Genucel. Order right now. Receive that Genucel jawline treatment absolutely free. Ordering classic plant stem cell therapy, just text EYES1 to 77453 or go to Genucel.com. And Teeter, get the fabulous inversion tables for your back health, your overall health. Again, you get $70 off, $100 worth of bonus accessories when you go to teeter.com/Laura. The Laura Ingram Podcast, we'll see you next time. Remember, America now, America forever.